Today is Wednesday. I've been told it's November 29th, 2023. And it's 2:39 now in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams. Thanks for finding the Mincing Rascals podcast. Share us with your friends. Give us a good rating. Let's get more folks under the tent. I think we do a nice job here. I know a lot of you do, too. I've heard from some of you who listen to us, and you listen to us a lot. So tell your friends and listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter, now putting out the kind of strange website, half novel, half Chicago history, Roseland, Chicago, 1972.
What's the website for that? How do folks click on it?
www.roselandchicago1972. That will bring it up. It's on Substack, so if you have the Substack app, that's also a great way to find it.
Groovy.
I'm Monica Eng, Axios Chicago reporter. You can find me at axios.com/Chicago.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly Substack newsletter, who has never heard, for years, has not heard anyone use the expression WWW anymore.
I know, that is so.
I can't believe I said that. I know.
It's very retro of you.
That is so 1998 of you. I mean, or whenever we, that used to be a big part of all the commercials we would read.
And so backslash.
I know.
And so yeah, I left off the HTTP, so, you know, to do that.
We would sometimes abbreviate it with 3-dub-dot, as though that was going to save time. But even like the name of your Substack newsletter, maybe the best way to tell people to find stuff anymore is just say type it in your browser, you know, Chicago, Roseland, history, yeah. And then boom, it's there. Just as Lori Lightfoot became not just mayor, but the most difficult kind of mayor, a COVID mayor, Brandon Johnson, I would say, is now not just a mayor, but he's a migrant mayor. The singular thing that he has to deal with or around is that. We talk about it every day on the radio. Each week on this podcast, a lot of us talk about the care of these migrants with our friends. The same way almost 4 years ago, we were consumed with COVID talk. And today, the plan has been for a migrant camp to go up in the southwest part of the city, in Brighton Park, just south of the Stevenson Expressway, not far from a rail yard, north and east of Midway Airport, at the site of a former zinc smelter. We had a zinc smelt? 2,000 people are about to call it home. On the radio, I've been saying, who does this harm? Why is this not a good idea?
That's a great question. And so this morning I've been in touch with NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, and the University of Chicago's Physical Sciences Division to find out exactly what harms a former zinc smelting area might cause for workers, for residents, or for someone who is living in a tent above it. They're still getting back to me, and I'm just surprised that nobody has brought this up yet. Like, are there actual problems with sleeping in a tent for 60 days near a former zinc smelting site? And if so, what are they? And are those dangers actually endangering the workers who are setting up the tents as we speak? So I don't have that answer. I don't know how bad or good or neither it is. But I do know that you're seeing two different sets of protesters outside the site. You're seeing folks who, frankly, look like me. I'm half Chinese. A lot of Asian protesters out there basically saying, we don't want people there. I was at a city council meeting, and a woman who got up and identified herself as Chinese American. She said she's been here 30 years. She spoke in Cantonese, and she said, we don't need more people here. We don't need these foreigners here. And Nicole Lee translated for her. And so there are those protesters, and then there are those who say this is not safe. I mean, they probably very, very justifiably say you shouldn't be building the airplane as you're flying, meaning why are they building the encampment while they're waiting for the results of the environmental assessment? The mayor's been called out on that for a while. But those who are saying this is dangerous, I just haven't heard them say exactly why it is dangerous. I think ideally you would want to do the environmental assessment and then build, but I just haven't heard it articulated why this is dangerous.
Yeah, right. I have the same question. They talk about there being heavy metals, perhaps mercury on the site. And apparently the city has done a study that we can't get a look at until maybe Friday as to exactly what's there. And again, there maybe there are trace elements there. How dangerous is this? If it's really dangerous, why are they allowing people to be out there working, building it? These are all really good questions. And the city's just been very slow to provide answers. It may be that the site is somewhat contaminated, but that, you know, we live in a city that's contaminated in a lot of ways. I live not too far from about a quarter mile from the Kennedy Expressway. And for years, there was, you know, lead problems in the soil here. And it's minimizing now that there has been lead-free gas. But, you know, that my whole neighborhood was filled with leaded soil and so on. And a lot of us live in houses with leaded paint. And of course, the lead feeder lines into the houses, the water lines. So it's not like everything else is all pure and safe. And then it is especially dangerous. But and again, the point that John, I've made with you before in this is like, this doesn't seem like a very good solution to me, putting people in tents, but I can't think of a better one right now. Winter's coming on and we're not going to have houses and apartments available for the people who are going to need them, and they have to have some place to stay, and police stations and airports are not the answers.
I was just going to push back a little bit on what you said about the pollution, Eric, because I mean, obviously, yeah, we're all living in the city with plenty of airborne particulates every place. But I know I grew up on the southeast side, right over the border in Dalton, and then most of my family's from Hegwisch, and my husband's family's all from Roseland. And we just grew up with just constant garbage dump smells and factory smells and that sort of thing.
And we liked it.
We did not like it. Oh, my God. We did not like it. But that's just what it was. That's one thing. Okay. But for the city to purposely be building on a site that it knows could be contaminated with heavy metals, that strikes me as absolutely bizarre. And when I read what they're saying to reporters about it, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
What are they saying? What are you talking about there?
The city acknowledges that they have to do an environmental assessment of it. They acknowledge it's not done yet. And yet they're starting to build it. And they're talking about, well, remediation is going on, and remediation can be ongoing while we're doing this. It's very unclear to me how you can strip the topsoil and clean that all up while you're covering it with gravel and building camps at the same time. It doesn't make any sense. The most utterly bizarre thing that I feel like I read about it, to me, shows that they know there's a possibility that there's going to be a problem here, which is that apparently, and Monica, you're reporting on this, so you can correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong, but the Gardaworld people have signed a contract in which they agree to not get paid for what they're doing over there if it turns out that there is an environmental problem and they can't use the site.
I did hear that they will pick up and move it. I didn't hear that part of the contract, and I really should take a closer look at the contract. I'll tell you what Ronnie Reese, who's the mayor's press secretary, sent me. He says, yesterday, Gardaworld delivered multiple pieces of equipment and material to the base camp at 3710 South California. Crews continue importing stone and grading the site. Today, Gardaworld will lay out materials, measure, and begin placing bases for structures on the site. If there are no complications, erection of the base camp may begin as early as Wednesday, so today. Additional details regarding environmental information will be provided this week. Again, common mitigation strategies are ongoing and anticipated for completion by the end of the week, weather permitting. The city is confident the property will be suited for the purpose for which it will be used.
Yeah, I'm going to make a prediction that the research they're going to reveal on Friday is that it's okay, and that there's some trace elements that we wouldn't want to be consuming daily, but it'll be safe for humans to be on top of for 60 days. And, you know, it's not like the zinc smelt just landed there. People have been living near it, maybe not on top of it, but it's been there all along. I don't know how long, but I mean, this isn't a brand new phenomenon. I can just see in the back of maybe the hearts or heads of everybody as well, it's better than what they got. So maybe it's dangerous. Maybe it's a little dangerous. I'm just copying what I think is maybe in the heart and head of some people. Don't put this down as my own view, but I'll bet that that is part of the justification or rationalization that our people are going through. They're like, well, look, they're from Venezuela. They had nowhere else to go. They were sleeping on the floor in a cop shop, and now we got them a place over here, and it'll be a heated tent. Not perfect, maybe not 100% safe, but good enough. And it was 17 degrees the other day. So yeah. While we have this, like, zinc thing, God, it's not like this isn't complicated enough. We just couldn't even find a place to put these people. And I'm wondering about that. Monica, how did they come to this location then? Of all of the places, they picked one that has a whole nother layer of issue, of protest.
Well, every elder was supposed to come up with sites in his or her ward used. Some came up with sites, some did not. And the city said, if you don't come up with sites, we will come up with them for you. This is 11 acres, somewhat south of the downtown. And it seemed, other than the form of zinc smelting, to be an ideal site for it. Although Julia Ramirez said that she was, the alder said that she was not contacted. So it seemed that the city identified this site. But again, you would hope that it would have been something that already had the blessing of the altar, but just because it has the blessing of the altar doesn't mean that the people want it. Poor Julia, she was attacked, or she was surrounded to the point where one of her aides had to be hospitalized. So, this doesn't seem to be an easy thing for anyone, but here we are. And you're right, you know, I go to police stations and I talk to migrants and I take pictures of them, and many of them don't have the luxury of sleeping on the floor of the police station, having rats crawl all over them. No, they are outside in tents surrounding the police station. So if these are heated tents, I guess one could say that a heated tent is better than a non-heated little, you know, pop-up tent outside of the police station or the park where I was talking to people, and there are dozens and dozens of them there.
Is the tents, they're supposed to be weatherproof to what, like 40 degrees or something like that? They
can stay heated to 70 if it's only down to 40 degrees outside. Pretty sure that's what I read.
But that's not good.
We're going to have an entire month or two where the average temperature is going to be well below that. It's going to be in the 20s. The average temperature is in the 20s in January in Chicago. So where does that put the temperature in these tents?
That's a good question. I mean, obviously, one can put on a coat in a tent. But I think we ran the story today in Axios that said that they're predicting a fairly warm and relatively dry Chicago winter this year.
Hooray.
No Illinois legislators are going to be broadcasting that because they're actually hoping for a cold winter to keep.
It's like that Monty Python sketch where the architect says, "Yes, it's not built all that well, but if the tenants are relatively sedentary, we should be all right." It's like, yes, if we don't get any bad weather,
okay,
we're fine.
Let's exclude for a moment the temperature of the tent or the zinc. Those are not small things, but we would still be having a version of this conversation, even if there was no environmental concern or weather concern, right, Monica? So what is the concern of the neighbors in any neighborhood, but in this case, Brighton Park?
Well, if you can go by the protests, the comments at meetings and the protests, it's usually people saying that there's crime, that there's prostitution, human trafficking, possible drug use, drug selling in these areas. I should also note that these people in tents are also vulnerable to the same things, to people stealing their things, people attacking them. As the Chinese American woman said at the city council meeting, she just doesn't want more foreigners around here. And it's a lot of it sounds really, frankly, racist and xenophobic. And it's very nippy. It's sort of like, yeah, take care of this, just not in my backyard.
We don't need any more foreign people here, but we do need that. I mean, isn't the irony that we actually do need people here? Chicago's losing population, Illinois is losing population, or not growing very fast, and we need workers. You help wanted signs everywhere, right?
I mean, talk to the Illinois Restaurant Association and the Hotel Owners Association. They are dying for workers. They cannot keep their operations open because nobody is applying for these jobs, they say.
Okay, but when you list all of those problems like crime and human trafficking and prostitution and drugs, Are you saying that the fear is that the migrants will be bringing those issues or that they will be victims of those issues?
That's what you hear from the people who show up at meetings.
That they will be the source of these things.
That they will be the source of them.
Where do they get that? What makes them say that?
There have been some citations that some people were illegally cutting hair downtown outside of one. I have not seen any evidence that someone has been arrested for drug trafficking or prostitution. People say that's happening. But I think, you know, a lot of it stems, just from my opinion, I think a lot of it stems from xenophobia.
Well, I completely understand that or suspect that. And so I think it's very easy for, here again, us on the radio, to sort of repeat these accusations or charges for which there's no evidence, not that I've read, heard, or seen.
I did hear about two shoplifting incidents.
Which per capita we would settle for.
We can't pretend that all of these people coming up are all law-abiding citizens, that some of the kids aren't going to get involved in gangs and so on. I mean, but that is normal. And the question is whether they are uniquely or especially prone to crime, and I don't see any evidence of that. And certainly if you keep them in poverty is correlated to crime. So the one answer has got to be to make sure that these migrants have work permits and are able to support themselves, because many of them clearly do want to support themselves. They want to work. They went through a lot to get here. They don't seem like they're indolent people or non-industrious people. If we can get them the proper permits to work, that would be a really good start to getting them permanent housing, getting them out of the tents and so on. I mean, that's got to be a key part of this plan.
You and I talked about that briefly on the radio, Eric, and I didn't have the statistic in front of me. I don't the source now, but my fairly solid understanding is that per capita, migrants commit less crime than residents of the country, city, or state, that they are not any more prone to any of these ills than the rest of us, and statistically are less so. Maybe if we keep them living on the street long enough, they'll fall prey to all of that, or they'll become part of that. But that's not the case. So if you said your neighborhood's going to grow by 2,000 people, you could do a lot worse than these 2,000 people. Unfortunately, they're living on an old zinc smelting site.
You know, speaking of statistics, what I've been trying to track down for the last 2 months is how many of them actually got work permits after President Biden finally allowed it. I have not been able to see evidence of a single work permit that has been granted in that time. I've worked with the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Human Services in Illinois. And what Human Services was able to tell me is that they have filed 260 applications. That was when I spoke to them last week. I said, did any of them come through? Does anybody now have a work permit to work legally since Biden made that call? And nobody's been able to show me any evidence. I'm really hoping at some point they do.
Politico had a story, I think it was this morning, talking about not Politico Illinois, but the national branch of it, about in New York City, that the paperwork mess is just frightening, and the delays are even when they say, yeah, we're going to do this, we're such a bureaucratic society that they just can't get it done. And so a lot of these migrants are resorting to working off the books, which, you know, you got to feed your family, right? I mean, I don't, it doesn't outrage me at all. And I certainly understand that, you know, you're going to go and work, but it's dangerous to be working without any permit, without any protection. You can't like sue an employer.
We've got a story out of Denver about a lot of Venezuelan migrants there who are lining up at Home Depot. Are they bonded if they get hurt in a construction accident? No. But the Department of Homeland Security, it's just, I don't understand. I was on the phone with them for like almost an hour saying, can you tell me when you might be able to tell me about one documented work permit coming through? We can't really say when. Well, can you give me is it three? Have you issued three or four? We can't really say. I'm like, I don't understand why this is so hard for you to tell me.
Are they motivated? Do they care? Do you get a sense that they're frustrated like we are, Monica?
They keep telling me we need comprehensive immigration reform, which is
Well, duh. Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, right. Call a talk show. But in the meantime, why don't you just do something about it? They're the people, right?
Yeah, and they're not able to explain to me what the bottlenecks are, because that could solve a lot of problems if people are able to make a decent living, it could clear a lot of these shelters out. So it's a continually frustrating subject.
So they line up in front of a Home Depot, and then people that are buying lumber for their project say, hey, get in the truck with me and I'll hire you for the day, right? That's not a situation unique to migrants. You see sometimes at the U-Haul place or the Home Depots that I've gone by, people standing on the corner looking for work, and you kind of get it. I don't know if they're legally here or not, but I think we all sort of understand what's about to happen, and we're happy to be part of it. You know, Eric, when you said, yeah, but then they don't have insurance and they can't sue and all of those things, I know that's unfortunate or inequitable, but I also think that would be the path that either they should take or somebody should pave.
They can't even be guaranteed to be paid a minimum wage. And they could get stiffed. They have no recourse. They have no job safety requirements that they're going to have to, they can fall back on. I mean, it's not a good system to have. And of course, at the same time, they're not paying taxes. And you know, they're probably being paid in cash, and that's not good either. I mean, the whole thing is really dysfunctional. And as Monica's pointed out, the bureaucracy in this country is just so slow. And this is an urgent problem. And it just seems like our country is not really equipped to gear up and fight a problem like this, or deal with a problem or a challenge like this with any dispatch.
Talk briefly, guys, about the black and brown people on the South and West Side who see all this anxiety, all of this anguish about accommodating these migrants when, in fact, we don't seem to be as invested in helping them right now. How fair is that complaint or observation of theirs?
Every single time you go to a city council meeting and there are the public comments at the beginning, there are always African-American commenters who get up there and basically call Brandon Johnson a traitor. They say, you are prioritizing foreigners and outsiders and non-Chicagoans over us. Where was the $30 million a month when it came to helping Englewood or Auburn Gresham? And he has to take it. I mean, he hears this at every city council meeting, and alders say the same thing. And I can see how hurtful that would seem. And for the longest time, he has said, we have to be able to try to help everyone. You know, when it came down to putting in place these 60-day limits, it seems like that may have been responding to some of those claims. But it's a big glaring question. I don't think everybody's going to be, you know, satisfied with two different buckets of money, because it just doesn't seem fair to a lot of people.
What is it that you think that they would like to have been invested in their communities? More housing, schools, neighborhoods?
Why did our mental health clinics close? Why do all the Jewel and Aldi's close? And then how about the homeless on our streets? Where do they get to sleep? How about 6 months of rental assistance for us?
With the Brighton Park location, since it's just an empty location, it is easier to see that there might be more xenophobia and just overall fear involved there. But there's have been a lot of places, and Woodlawn is a good example, where it's perfectly understandable, really, that the people who live in that community are feeling overlooked. In Woodlawn, the Wadsworth School that got turned into a migrant shelter, the community had been trying to get reopened as a community center for years and years. And of course, the city can never come up with the money, never does it. And then all of a sudden, poof, it can happen for this purpose. To me, it is perfectly understandable that they feel that way. And that's kind of the issue here is that there is a conflict in where the resources go. The resources are not infinite. So we can't completely pretend that we're not spending some resources on migrants that could have been spent on Chicagoans. I think the number that I hear, and I don't know exactly where it comes from, is a potential of 60,000 homeless people in Chicago. I really don't know exactly how they get there from the snapshot that they do yearly of people on the street on one single night. That is a number that gets thrown around. And I think we all know, I certainly see homeless people every day in my neighborhood and everywhere else I go in the city, really. I can't think of a single neighborhood where I don't see some homeless people anymore.
I think that number is based on the number of people who through the course of 1 year are unhoused, which is not the same as sleeping on the street. And when they take this annual count, the number is far, far lower because they're just counting people who are actually in the shelters and on the street. But the number's still too high, and we still need and now we really need a lot more room for them.
Yeah, the snapshot actually from 2023 was a little over 6,000 homeless people on the street that night when they counted, and that had gone up from not quite 4,000.
2023 was 6,000, but does all
2023? Yeah,
but
6,000.
So does this assume though that the money that is going to be spent or is being spent for migrant care could have been used for the poor or the homeless in Chicago? I don't know that were it not for this, they would get that money. For instance, has any money been subtracted from resources that are dedicated to the homeless and poor in Chicago? I think not.
Every time Lori asked that, she said nothing has been taken from those funds. That said, for the longest time, we were hearing that the state was not going to be kicking any more money this year into migrant aid. Suddenly, J.B. Pritzker has a press conference and says, ta-da, I came up with $160 million. And we're all like, where'd it come from, dude? Where did that money come from?
Yeah.
And he said, the Department of Human Services has a line item that is for wraparound services for Illinois residents. Could that $160 million have been used for other Illinois residents? I don't know.
You didn't really call him dude, did you? By way of the press conference. Kate, you said it's perfectly understandable that these people would react that way. And I think it's perfectly predictable that they would. And I guess it is understandable. But if we're prioritizing our sympathies, mine are more to the migrants than they are to the people who aren't sleeping on the floor of a police department or in a tent on Lakeshore Drive. Some of them are, mind you, but we're just talking about a whole population of people who are utterly without resources here. It's like there's a fire and you've got to put it out. Maybe I'm an outlier in this. You know, our news click, our daily web poll question, which is thoroughly unscientific, but sometimes instructive. We asked, should the city of Chicago be providing shelter for the newly arrived migrants? That was it. Not here or there or this way or that way. Should we even provide shelter this winter? 69% said yes. I was amazed at how many people said no. That's discouraging to me.
It is sad. I mean, obviously, I agree with you. They're here, and we do have to house them. We can't just leave them freezing on the street. I'm sure we all agree with that, that once they're here, we must do everything we can.
Well, but John's point is that, no, we don't all agree with that 40% of
his audience.
No, I meant
just us.
Just us four or five
around
good people.
The table here,
the five good ones.
All right.
Yeah.
I am, hearing from readers and from commenters, certainly at City Hall, a growing weariness with the issue, and even from politicians, frankly. And so, I don't know if you guys saw the New York Times had that the piece. Jonathan Swan and Maggie Haberman talked to Trump aides, saying that he would crack down on migration and put everybody in cages and send them out. And I think he was tapping into, sadly, a growing weariness, at least in New York, Boston, Denver, and Chicago, where the migrants are being sent, with the issue. I don't want to know what people are going to say inside that voting booth.
I think that some of the weariness, though, is a result of the lack of any leadership or direction from the city, just speaking from Chicago, right? Like if we had had a plan all along, we wouldn't be so weary. I think our weariness isn't because 2,000 people are scattered around the city, 20,000. It's because we're beating ourselves up about what even to do about it. And then we finally come up with a place for at least 2,000 of them. And damn, it's on a zinc thing. And now what the hell are we going to do? And what I'm getting a little tired of is Brendan Johnson's speechifying about the good nature of the churches and the people of Chicago that are showing what we're all about. It almost felt like passing the buck to me because he said, well, wait until Friday and I'll tell you what we're going to do, or we'll manage these concerns you have. The churches are ahead of you on this. You're the mayor. You've known about this before you became mayor. How is it that it's taken us this long?
I do think that Brandon Johnson having this, constant, just all optimism, all sunniness. As long as we're wonderful and as nice as we can be, everything will be fine. And if it isn't, it's because we haven't been nice enough, basically. That kind of attitude is, I think, irritating to people. Yeah. It is a problem. Let's acknowledge it's a problem. It's a federal problem. I personally don't really understand why even the Democratic mayors can't just kind of suck it up and band together with even, God forbid, the governor of Texas together to say, we're all in this together. It's a federal problem. Let's all go to Washington together and demand that it be dealt with in a national way instead of this absolutely crazy system. It's not even a system that's going on now, but that does need to include potentially controlling the number of people who are coming in.
It certainly happened, and it's been happening in Europe, that the flood of immigrants has energize the right wing there. Exactly. The problem with going to Washington and asking for money is that Congress is completely dysfunctional and it's not going to pass an extra spending bill for the migrants. I mean, I think that I can't imagine the Republicans going along with that at this point. And they're probably even some conservative Democrats.
What if the Republican like governors banded together with people like Brandon Johnson and Eric Adams?
They don't want to do that, Kate. They like the fact that they're sending these little human missiles to Democrat cities, including the one that's going to host the DNC.
I've asked my colleagues in D.C. I said, so what everyone's saying is the answer is comprehensive immigration reform. And my colleague said, this is a political winner for Republicans, pointing the finger at Democrats and saying, wah, wah. And so why would they try to stop it? Why would they try to stem the
I think the biggest misunderstanding that our listeners have, too, maybe your readers, is that these people that are in Chicago are not here illegally. They're legal asylum seekers, and that our declaring ourselves a sanctuary city was not an invitation to this problem. They aren't all here because we said we're a sanctuary city, and they are not here illegally.
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. Some did not use the app to get in here. Some did make their appointment through the app. Some are going to file for asylum. Others are here under TPS. It's a very complicated system. There are at least 3 to 4 buckets of people who have very different rights and standings, and will go through different procedures to gain either citizenship or a green card. And then you have 180,000 undocumented people who have been in Chicago for a long time, who are a little upset that the new arrivals are getting TPS and are getting work.
What does TPS stand for?
Temporary protected status. Anybody who is a Venezuelan national who came here before July 31st can get temporary protected status and a work permit. Others who maybe came here without declaring what they're coming in with can apply for asylum. It's a very long process. Once you get the lawyer and do all the paperwork and present your claim, you can't get a work permit for 6 months. So some people who were thinking of applying for asylum are going to go with TPS now.
So the TPS people are completely separate from the asylum seekers, or they?
Well, now you're seeing a Venn diagram. You're seeing people who were going to apply for asylum saying, wait a minute, if I apply for TPS, I can get a work permit hopefully in 2 months rather than 6 months after I file all my paperwork. And frankly, some Chicago officials are telling migrants that they're not doing themselves a favor talking to journalists and saying, hey, I came here because I wanted better schools for my kids, or I came here because I wanted a better job. Those are not asylum claims. Economic hardship is not an asylum claim. You have to fear for yourself because of some sort of political or other status you have back in your country. And so they say that they're screwing themselves and they're screwing their future asylum claims by telling journalists things like that.
Well, of course, that is part of the issue, that the entire asylum system is kind of broken, since that is not what it was meant for. But let me just give one more thing for my Pollyanna notion to say, if people like Brandon Johnson and Eric Adams got together and said, hey, we now agree with you, Texas Governor Abbott, that we do need to do something about this. We do need comprehensive reform. We do need to control the border a little bit. Come work with us on that. Come with us to Washington. You say you want to control the border. You're not just trying to complain for political points. Let's get together and do this together. And then let them say no.
I can't talk you off that cliff, can I?
I'm just saying that if they did that, and DeSantis and Abbott would not cooperate,
it would
just show, you know, that the Republicans are completely insincere about trying to fix this, at least before the next presidential election.
Monica, why?
Well, I think really,
it would be a good strategy, in my opinion.
What Dick Durbin says to me, he says that he and McCain miraculously passed an incredible bill for comprehensive immigration reform. He said Republicans killed it in the House.
I just think that the Republicans are just licking their chops about the prospect of there being thousands of migrants in Chicago during the convention next summer, the Democratic convention, and split screen coverage of maybe migrant protesters and so on going along with and people living in tents and tent cities in the city where the Democrats are holding their convention. I think they're very excited about that prospect.
Did you see or hear the video or the audio of Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, who was questioning at a Senate hearing this week a professor from Yale who studies crime, or actually I think it was health, but crime is a function of health in a way, or one or the other. And he said that Chicago is like this national shooting gallery. And can you explain to me why it is?
Let me ask you this. Why do you think that Chicago has become America's largest outdoor shooting range? Do you think it's because of Chicago citizens who have no criminal record, but who have a gun in their home for protection, or perhaps for hunting? Or do you think it's because of a finite group of criminals who have rap sheets as long as King Kong's arm?
So Mississippi, Louisiana, and Missouri actually have higher firearm death rates. Obviously, there's certain...
What about Chicago?
So I don't live in Chicago. It's not my primary area of research.
You don't have an opinion on that?
I think there's easy access to firearms combined with environmental conditions, lack of great education. There have actually been studies showing that when you green vacant lots and repair abandoned buildings in urban neighborhoods, you see decreases in gunshots, in violence, as well as in stress and depression in the neighborhoods around them.
No disrespect, Doc, but that sounds a lot like word salad to me.
That's a word salad, and nobody understands what you're talking about. And I thought she was making perfect sense. I've heard word salads. We have a mayor who's good at them. This was not a word salad. I don't know why I'm on that tangent all of a sudden here. It came up. But it's really remarkable to hear. Monica, I'm looking at you. Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I mean, if it's going to be about Burr, last week there was witness testimony talking about how he gave salt and pepper shakers to one of the gentlemen who he thought might be able to give him some property tax business. And so we'll be looking at Burke's famous penchant for creating and distributing custom-made swag.
I thought it was just his book. I thought it was just his books that he handed out, but he has other items as well?
Hats, Ed Burke hats, hams. Those weren't branded. But a good friend of mine, who's actually a good friend of Eric and Johanna's, when I go over to his house, I notice that there are these incredible salt and pepper, like I don't want to say pewter, salt and pepper grinders that say Ed and Ann Burke.
Wow.
Got those at a dinner. Those were also the bribes, the gifts that were given to someone.
I just really quickly, how you're following this trial, Monica, maybe closer than I am, certainly. What's your take on it so far?
It's going about as I thought it would, you know, laying out, you know, this particular instance where someone felt like someone that Burke was leaning on them for a favor, and this particular instance where Burke was leaning on them for a favor. I didn't expect the swag to come up. I didn't expect so many people to get COVID, and I didn't expect the dogs to be barfing in the courtroom. But it's going just, you know, in terms of the stories of laying out this practice, this alleged practice of leaning on people for favors is kind of how I thought it would go.
I thought that the post office case, portion of the case, would bear more fruit than it is to me so far. That's the $600 million redevelopment of the post office. There's a developer that was going to come in. They had to get the water working in the old post office again. And Burke figures that if he can expedite the water and help the developer out, that maybe they'll throw their tax business to him. And on a phone call, Danny Solis captures Ed Burke saying exactly that. Make sure you recommend our firm.
To his contractor. So just wanted to let you know that.
While you're at it, recommend the good firm of Crafter and Burke to do the tax work.
All right. I certainly will.
And we can certainly talk about a marketing arrangement for you.
Okay. All right.
He said it in sort of a almost humorous, you know what I mean, rib tickling kind of way. And I'm sure the defense is going to say, of course he'd like the business. It wouldn't be a crime if Danny said, hey, I know somebody who does that kind of work. But is that the smoking gun? And I thought, I don't think it is. The way it was said, I didn't think it was the thing that was going to convict him.
Yeah, that was less powerful than I thought it would be. The Field Museum stuff felt like there seemed to be a threat, like, you know, you're not going to get your admission hike because I'm the head of the finance committee, and if I recommend that the park district doesn't do that, that felt like there was an implication there. But yeah, I mean, if they're looking for a smoking gun, I don't think we've seen. I wonder if they've got some more, if they've got some bigger fish that they're going to throw our way. But I hate to say time will tell because editors hate that. But
yes, so we've heard. But, you know, there was two parts of that comment, too, where Burke says, on the one hand, it'd be nice if you recommended my good firm. And then he says to Danny Solis, he says, and then we can talk about a marketing arrangement for you. There's a euphemism for cash under the table. Danny Solis isn't in the marketing business. He said, we can talk about a marketing arrangement for you. Monica, what does that mean? Or Kate, what do you think that means?
Well, I guess we all know what that really means, right? He's going to get a kickback under the table for recommending the good law firm of Clafter and Burke. And actually, I don't know if it's going to be the smoking gun, but I feel like that is the strongest thing that's come out so far in the whole trial. I mean, as we were talking about, I think last week, I really felt like he just did sound like a grouchy old man as far as the Field Museum was concerned, and just kind of throwing out in the middle of a conversation that he was mad as opposed to a direct threat against them. So I really felt like he might skate on that one. But this is, I don't know how you take that any other way.
The words did come out of his mouth.
They absolutely did. And they talked about it again later in the videotaped meeting,
Yeah,
which, if anybody didn't see that on the news, you can get the videotape version very quickly from the Crane's version of the coverage. And they talk about it again. And he talks specifically about, I forget his exact wording, but he says, yeah, we're going to figure out something for you. We just have to be careful to make sure we do it right so it doesn't look like something illegal. You know, the thing about Alderman Burke, I've heard a lot of people during this coverage say that he seems to not have any sense of himself, that he's, you know, just completely self-absorbed, that kind of thing. And he's not like that in general. Like at city council meetings, that delivery that you heard, yeah, while you're at it, recommend the good firm of Clafter and Burke, that's his typical sort of delivery. He's always kind of half laughing at himself when he says stuff like that.
But so what's the implication of that? That he is
what I mean is that's why it looks a lot better on paper than it than how it will play when you listen to it from a jury, because he sounds like he's kidding around. Mm-hmm. And he does that all the time. Okay, remember the Field Museum. The guy whose goddaughter he was trying to, it was his goddaughter And he was trying to get that field museum internship for former alderman Terry Gabinski's
daughter.
Daughter.
That was his daughter.
And when Gabinski retired from the council after being there himself for like 25 years at least, and this was back in the late 90s, Alderman, you know, they did their all their farewells for him, and Alderman Burke, being very good friends with him, well, he would anyway make the longest speech because that's what he does. But he was really funny. He was like, yeah, and I'm just going to recommend that Alderman Gabinski, you know, you might want to look into lobbying. You might want to, you know, tell these potential clients. So you might want to point out to them how you will get the run of the city council floor, and that will, you know, get you our ears and that sort of thing. And everyone was just laughing uproariously.
Really? Really?
Yeah, because right now, aldermen, when they retire, they alone among anyone else have a right to go onto the council floor during meetings or at any time. Nobody else can do that but former aldermen.
Really?
So they become lobbyists, and then they can just go talk to their pals on the council floor and lobby them. That's his persona.
Well, the jurors don't know that. They don't know his history. They
exactly.
aren't even from Chicago. So on fresh
right,
ears,
right.
maybe that will look. Because of the 1-2 punch of that Clafter and Burke tax work, the second part was the one that was almost damning or sinister, you know. And mm-hmm. we'll talk about a marketing arrangement for you. There's a whole nother tuna or Chicago speak line out of this trial so far.
I still am not hearing the outrageous behavior, this outrageous evidence of corruption that is going to get a jury all fired up enough to get 12 men and women on that jury to convict. Right now, I the defense argument's going to be, he wanted the business. Yeah, he was grumpy to the field museum, but nobody ever had to follow through. Even the Burger King thing, it's like he never got what he wanted out of this. He was just kind of blowing smoke. And of course, that was Blagojevich's defense also, that Blagojevich had all these schemes. But there were a lot of other things that Blagojevich did actually do. Like, you know, the way he treated the children's hospital and so on, that really dirtied him up, I think, and made it easier to convict him on these other things. I've been reading these stories, and I haven't had this, like, you know, throw down the newspaper in anger and fury at the corruption. It's, you know, it seems very garden variety, heavy-handed use of your influence, but I don't know. So far, I haven't seen it, but I'm not in the courtroom. So,
well, I've been thoroughly frustrated by it all, but I completely agree with you, Eric, that there's not one thing where he says, okay, here's the deal. They don't get it unless I get money, you know, in my pocket. And then it happens. You just for what did we say, 4 years of or is it five? Of evidence gathering and all of the resources and all of the wires and all of the guy was talking into microphones and cameras for years he didn't know, and they don't have anything so far that I've heard, Eric, that is the big gotcha. So I'm with you on that, but I'm thoroughly disgusted or dismayed by the kind of behavior we're reading about. But yeah, is this going to put the guy in jail? I don't know. You know, one of our stories that the Tribune had mentioned that, of course, his wife, Ann Burke, is a former Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court. And Ray Long, or maybe Jason Meisner, whoever was writing that piece, they had half a sentence that sort of inferred that it was no coincidence that her husband, as powerful as he was, that she was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. As though he used his influence to somehow get her into that position as well. I always had the highest regard for her. I was always mystified by the relationship. But I always thought she was a good person, a public servant. I didn't have any problems with her. I see the two of them with these withered looks on their faces coming in and out of the courtroom every day. It's kind of a pathetic picture.
I think their point was that it was because of him that she got slated for her first judgeship. And of course, his clout would have helped all the way along. But, you know, both things can be true. I think you're right that Ann Burke has an extremely good reputation. You really never hear a bad word about her. So, I mean, both things can be true, that she wouldn't have gotten a judgeship and then ultimately to the Illinois Supreme Court were it not for that, and that she herself plays it straight while she's on the bench.
Yeah, yeah, I guess you're right. Both things can be true. One last thing I wanted to talk to you guys. Eric, I read the story and was a little perplexed by the details. But for just a minute, let's talk about suburban prep basketball in Hinsdale South. There is a really good player who is barely on the team and isn't getting to play right now. There's a lawsuit involved as well. Can you sort of tell us that story?
Yeah, I'll summarize it. He's a senior. Brendan Savage is his name, and he was all conference in his sophomore and junior years, and he scored 35 points against Proviso East last season. Very, very good player. But last year, he didn't get along with the varsity coach, whose name is Michael Moretti, and he filed a complaint with the school district saying that the coach had bullied him. And the district found that the coach didn't bully him, but it said that the coach's interactions and communications were inappropriate and inconsistent with the high standards of professionalism expected of such employees. And they demoted the head coach from varsity to freshman, Michael Moretti. And then they elevated the coach who was the sophomore coach, whose name is Belcaster. And Belcaster ended up during tryouts this year cutting Brendan Savage from the team. Again, this kid was a star player, sophomore and junior years all conference. I mean, it was about as flagrant and blatant an instance of of retaliation. And evidently Belcaster and Moretti are friends. So it was a very, very obvious case of
retribution,
abuse of power. Retribution, abuse of power, and you see the headline, and the headline online was like, "Parent sues after son cut from basketball team," and you're thinking, "Oh my God, this is one of these helicopter suburban parents whose precious little child has been denied an opportunity, and this child has never been told no. We're going to sue." It's not the case at all here. The case is of a grotesque abuse of power on the part of this coach. I mean, I can see no possible reason. There's no allegation that the kid broke, he was drinking or burglarizing houses or anything like that. This is just as clear a case of retribution as I've ever seen. And what is appalling to me right now, first of all, he is back on the team. The school board voted him in back on the team on Monday night.
The school board voted the kid back on the team?
The Hinsdale Township School Board reinstated him to the team on Monday night. He did not play on Tuesday during Tuesday's home opener, but he's apparently going to be suited up to play on Friday. When the team plays on Friday, and the question is, of course, is the coach going to play him? And what's the coach going to do? And he was playing games with reporters after the game on Tuesday night. He was saying that they would ask him questions like, how are you going to handle this? And he's like, I can't hear you. I don't know. And I can't hear you. And they would ask these questions, and then the coach walks away. So not only is he a tyrant, he's an immature tyrant. And the fact that Hinsdale South hasn't fired this guy is unconscionable. And the fact that they haven't disciplined everybody who was enabling him in doing this after it's become clear what happened is also unconscionable. I mean, apparently the district is in something of an uproar. The students are wearing T-shirts in support of Brendan Savage. And it's just a great, great story. I mean, it's an appalling story, but it's a really interesting story. And I hope that the kid comes back and scores a lot of points and the team does well. And then he goes to Michigan and brings back that sorry basketball program.
But it's funny because they said, okay, the varsity coach has so abused his position that he can't be the varsity coach. So let's have him coach the 14-year-old freshman team. Like, wait, that doesn't make any sense. If he's not suitable to coach the seniors, why is he suitable to coach the – if I'm the freshman parent, I'm like, wait a minute. What? How do I get this guy? This is crazy.
Excellent.
That was the part I could not figure out, right? The school said he didn't bully your son, but his behavior was completely inappropriate. But he didn't actually bully him, so he didn't actually break any policy.
Yeah.
But okay. we'll sink them down to the freshman level. Eric, you have you not seen anything about what the actual allegations were?
Yeah, I'd like to know what that non-bullying but inappropriate behavior was.
Yeah.
Was he yelling at the kid? I don't understand.
Well, I haven't seen anything. My guess is that from dealing with coaches and watching coaches and being coached over the years, it was probably one of these hard-ass coaches who would yell and swear and belittle their players. Brendan Savage wasn't having any of it. So
yeah.
I don't know how awful it was, but bad enough to get him demoted. But the fact that the new coach decides to, I mean, what he could have done clearly and in much more subtle ways, kept him on the team, but, you know, not played him as much as maybe he should have, which would have been, again, awful, but probably a little bit harder to file a lawsuit on. This was just so blatant. You cut your star player
for no reason. Okay, but then you sue them for what? Not enough minutes, not enough uniform time.
You can't now. Of course, that's going to be a really interesting thing to watch, which is that he is reinstated to the team. And the Savage family lawyer has been saying that, you can't put him on the team and then not play him because that's still punishing him. But then you're getting into micromanaging a coaching decision. And that's a tougher area.
Well, that's why I'm shocked that the school board took it upon themselves to. I didn't know a school board could decide who wears a uniform on the basketball team. I think the school board could appoint a coach or approve a program, but I didn't know that they could say this kid is on the team and that kid is not. Like, if I was the school board, I would say that's not our job. We are not interested in micromanaging at that level, but we'll be happy to fire the coaches.
I think that's what they should have done. I think it was kind of weird that they reinstated the kid to the team, even though he clearly belonged on the team. That does seem like something that would be out of the purview of the school board. But again, what a mess! What a mess! And what a terrible thing for that adult coach to do. So,
yeah, there's a lot of school boards in the country that are glad they don't have to deal with COVID anymore and all of that, masking and not masking, hybrid or not hybrid. Say, okay, whew, we got all that done. Wait, what? Wait, the coach did what? And I did see, Eric, where the coach did hear a couple of questions from the press, but then suddenly when they said, now, what about this kid? Is he going to get to play? Is he going to wear a uniform? That's when he feigned a hearing problem and then just walked away. That's bad. That's bad management.
I mean, you can say, look, it's matters under litigation. I can't comment on it.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, that would have worked. It's a personnel issue that everybody walks away with. It's a personnel matter. We don't talk about those. And I was ready to put on my boomer hat when producer Pete first told me about this. I said, well, you know, when I was a kid, if you had a bad attitude, that was just as bad as not making your free throws. They'd throw you off. You wouldn't be on. You would be benched if you look cross-eyed at the coach. You don't do that. And the world has changed. Kids and families are much more empowered, if you will, and sometimes I think too much so. But I'm with you, Eric. This doesn't seem to be one of those cases. This seems to be one of its own sort.
If a kid were really insolent to the coach, if he had broken team rules, yeah, that's a totally different story. But that's not what happened here.
I wish my parents would have sued the coach. I should have gotten to play a lot more,
I didn't know what to think as I was reading it, because without knowing even the allegations, you're kind of up in the air going, well, who's right? Who's wrong? Mm-hmm, was the parent just expecting too much? Was the kid oversensitive? And then you get to the current coach cupping his hand around his ear and pretending he can't hear anything from the reporters. And you're just like, okay, no. Apparently, everything the child and his parents said must be true.
So here in Chicago, we've had problems at every level of athletics. The Chicago Bears, really all of our teams have had coaching and management issues. The Northwestern Wildcats had to get rid of their coach and have had problems in three different departments. And now Hinsdale South has its own unique coaching story. So I guess it'll be incumbent upon us to next week, when we drop the next issue of the Mincing Rascals podcast, Eric, report back to us on how Hinsdale South did. Did this young man get to play? And what the latest is on that, because I'm really curious to see now if he's going to get the ball or if he's even going to be able to step on the floor during the game.
Yeah, just a really interesting sidelight is that all the problems at Northwestern, the interim coach was recently named permanent coach and was just named Big Ten Coach of the Year.
Yeah, right. He's got them. I mean, I thought this was going to be a year for Northwestern that they would lose almost all of their games. They would have lost a lot of players. They would have lost a lot of recruits. And everybody just couldn't wait for the season to be over. They're going to a bowl game. They're going to a bowl game this year. And the kids really have, and the kids really played for that coach. And remember, this was the same coach who wished that the kids had not worn a Us Against the World t-shirt before the season started. And I thought, you know, really, guys, it's not that. It's not that. But that was kind of a rally cry from some of the assistant coaches and kids. And I thought that was wrongheaded. And he didn't put the kibosh on that. But turns out he's done a real nice job with that program this year.
Yeah, the story of David Braun, that coach there, is the story that we kind of were hoping that the Tyson Bagent story might be, right? The guy who comes out of nowhere and becomes a hero. And, you know, Bagent was pretty mediocre as a fill-in quarterback for Justin Fields. But David Braun has he's the real deal, evidently. I mean, like you said, he coached them to they're 7-5 now, I think, or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they're definitely going to.
They beat Illinois. They beat Wisconsin. Yeah. Kate Plies, Monica Ng, Eric Zorn, all part of the podcast this week. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. And we'll drop another podcast on you next week.
All right. Thanks, everybody. That was really fun.
Kate, nice job. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Kate. It was good.
Bye. Great.
Adios.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.